This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Mikhail Lefrak. Vermont's system of education funding is complicated, and that's perhaps putting it mildly. Trying to explain how it works is a little like trying to solve the math problem on the blackboard at Harvard in the movie Good Will Hunting. So rather than trying to pull a Matt Damon and be the only one who can make sense of it, Governor Phil Scott is taking an eraser to that blackboard. His administration is instead offering a new formula for education funding in Vermont. It proposes fundamental changes for how schools and districts around the state would operate and who would make decisions directly affecting students and the people who work in education. We're endeavoring to get an education today on what the new system would look like if the legislature ultimately approves Scott's proposal. And we're starting with Vermont's Education Secretary Zoe Saunders. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
And listeners, you can join this conversation as well. Give us a ring if you've got questions. 1-800-639-2211. You can also send an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. So, Secretary Saunders, first, let me start by asking, what is the core essence of this new plan for education in Vermont, both in terms of funding and how schools would function, that is fundamentally different from what Vermonters know right now?
The governor's proposal is an exciting opportunity for us to strengthen our public education system. As you noted in the introduction, our current education system is facing many challenges, and we've heard a call for bold leadership to think about how to redesign and strengthen our public education system. This proposal proposes three main policy levers because we know that we need to look at this work holistically because the challenges are so complex. So first and foremost, this proposal is about promoting educational quality. And in order to do that, we're going to be clear around establishing a core set of expectations for what we want all of our children to be able to benefit from. This plan is about ensuring that a child that lives in a rural community benefits from the same opportunities as a child that lives in a bigger town. And so to achieve that, we need to think about how we fund education and make sure that children that have similar needs receive similar resources. In our current system, that's not the case. Another third part of this proposal is to think about governance so we can also operate at scale and ensure that we can deliver a high-quality education that is equitable across all communities of Vermont.
Well, let's get to some specifics. I understand that there's about 119 districts right now in the state of Vermont, and this plan would have them come down to 5, if I have this right. It's a consolidation effort here, and it would put more control in the hands of a state government with 5 large regional school boards. Is that part of the plan?
Would reframe that. The plan is really looking at getting to the optimum scale so that we can deliver educational quality in a way that is equitable. Our current system has a very complex governance structure. We have 52 supervisory unions under which there are 119 school districts, and this proposal moves us to a total of 5 districts. The idea for that is actually to be able to ensure that we are able to deliver the appropriate resources to all of our schools. In our current construct, our districts often struggle to hire key roles, and they often struggle to have very specialized resources. So what this plan does is it enables us to get the right level of expertise in a region who can provide support to schools in ways that some school districts don't have those opportunities to access those really important resources.
Well, up till now, in terms of spending, let's talk about that. Different districts have had quite a lot of wiggle room to spend as they want. That has resulted in the property tax hikes that have upset so many Vermonters and led to a lot of no votes on school budgets last year. Under this new plan, how would districts receive the cash they need to meet student needs?
This new plan proposes a foundation formula, and that formula establishes a base amount of funding to ensure that students are getting a very robust and well-rounded education. And on top of that, there are weights, and that is making adjustments for need for students. Our current system is designed to promote taxpayer capacity, but that doesn't necessarily equate to students who have similar needs receiving the similar resources. And so we see that as an equity challenge currently, where we have different levels of spending in our districts, even though students might have the same needs. So this foundation formula is based on research and evidence, and provides a very funding for robust educational delivery and accounts for additional need of students. So through this plan, it would be really ensuring that children benefit from those same resources across the state, no matter where they live or the wealth of their community.
Can you tell us anything about how much money we can expect to see each district get, assuming the idea here is, as you said at the top, to distribute the cash supply equally?
Absolutely. So this week, we'll be providing further details around what went into the calculation and get concrete on the actual funding. So all of those details will be shared later in the week. I can share more around the methodology for how we came to that amount. It was really important to us that we focus this plan around educational quality and building a base funding amount that is generous and is ensuring that we can deliver a well-rounded education. So what is built into that are some assumptions around what constitutes high quality education and what districts and schools will need in terms of resources to deliver on that. Within the plan, there is flexibility for the districts to make adjustments based on needs of their students, but the methodology is designed to make sure that this is research-based, that we can, as a state, guarantee appropriate resources to provide a range of educational services. We did this work in consultation with the feedback we heard from our Listen and Learn tour. So as an agency, we traveled all across the state, and we asked for Vermonters to help us define student success and also to prioritize those educational services that are most important to them. So we've accounted for that within the base funding to make sure that districts can offer a wide range of elective opportunities, that they can offer expanded early childhood education, further college and career exploration. And all of these things are prioritized in the plan, along with promoting teacher pay equity. So this proposal is not just about funding. The proposal is about how we can ensure that our funding system delivers on our values for Vermont and ensures a really high quality educational experience for every child. Because of that, it is complex and there's multiple levers to this proposal. So it's looking at funding, educational quality, and governance. They're interconnected in this work. And what we've heard really clearly is that we can't just make small tweaks, that we really need to look at redesigning our system in a way to strengthen a public education in Vermont so that we have world-class schools in every single community and are able to deliver an excellent education for every student.
Okay, we've got quite a few calls to get to. Let's take one now from Paul, who's on the line in Bristol. Hi, Paul.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. What's your question for Secretary Saunders?
Excellent. Well, I don't necessarily have a question so much as I have some comments. I'm the executive chef of Mount Abraham Unified School District in Bristol. And one of the things I was concerned about was the disbanding of universal school meals. I expressed that in a letter in November back to Governor Phil Scott's office, and I got a wonderful response that I felt was very nicely written. However, in the response, they said that they were not planning on changing the school meals at all. And here we are months later, and that's the case now. And it removes a lot of opportunity for students to, if you want to talk about, I hear a lot of equity and equality. Universal school meals is the most fundamental human right, not just a need, that students benefit from. Every single student, hands down. It increases participation by 90% in breakfasts, and the kids have access to healthy meals. In Vermont, it stimulates a local economy. where...
I'm sorry to cut you off there, but I understand your point there, and I actually want to ask this question of Secretary Saunders here, because as I understand it, Paul is correct, the Universal Meals Program would be something dropped under this new plan. Is that a cost-saving measure? Why is that program being dropped? As Paul said, it helps so many students in the state of Vermont.
The governor's proposal is about continuing to ensure that students receive public school meals if they are not able to afford it. So it's transitioning from universal school meals to a means-tested approach and making sure that those children that are in poverty can still receive free meals. Part of this proposal is looking at the overall approach, and certainly there are really tough decisions that will be made as we look at the General Assembly around how to prioritize funding. As the governor indicated in his address, we know that taxpayers need relief, and so he has signaled a really strong intent to buy down the property taxes and looking at where are there opportunities to reduce funding in certain programs to achieve that outcome. I expect that there'll continue to be further conversation as we look at the overall plan, and knowing that this is a very comprehensive approach and we're facing a really challenging financial crisis now, and we'll need to be thoughtful and intentional around what choices are made to ensure that we can deliver a high quality education for every student.
All right. I want to thank Paul from Bristol for that phone call. You know, Secretary Saunders, there are many other factors not directly related to education that nevertheless will likely influence the affordability factor. And I know that's a big part of this plan. We got this question from Siobhan in Granville, who writes, the state took control of teacher health insurance, promising cost savings, and instead those rates have been increasing by double digits each year, a cost which has been absorbed by the school budgets that the governor criticizes and paid for by property taxes. How does this plan offer any different option?
The things we've heard as we've traveled all across the state, we have heard that there's a lot of statewide pressures on our school budgets. And part of what this plan is designed to do is ensure that we can have more stabilization in our funding mechanism to really future-proof our education system. So you've noted the high cost of healthcare. We also know that there are other influences that are impacting school budgets. And we need to make sure that we're developing a system that is really investing our dollars in ways that are going to have the best outcomes for students and can sustain some of the economic downturns and also shifts in funding that are beyond a local school district's control. Additionally, this plan is positioned within a broader context of our affordability challenges in the state of Vermont. And we're working really closely, the Agency of Education, with our other sister agency partners and thinking about how to position the education plan within the context of some broader strategies that are being implemented to address the larger affordability challenges facing the state of Vermont.
Let's take another call from David, who's on the line in Duxbury. Hi, David.
Hi.
And you've got a question for Secretary Saunders?
Yes, I heard on a VPR interview a couple months ago that the student-to-staff ratio in Vermont is the lowest in the nation at 3.6 students per staff. The next lowest was Maine at 4.8. Obviously, that's the elephant in the room. The student-to-staff ratio has to be increased to make education affordable in Vermont. Your comments?
Thanks for the call, David. Secretary Saunders?
When we compare Vermont to other states, we do have some of the lowest staff to student ratios in the country. And it's important as we think about staffing to put that in the broader context of our current workforce, the state of our current workforce. We have a lot of challenges in filling many of those positions across the state. Many of our schools are struggling to hire and retain teachers. Many of our districts are struggling to hire and retain principals and central office staff. So we know that we have some considerable challenges in being able to staff for these positions. We also know that we have a number of our teachers on provisional licenses. So as we go into this broader conversation around how to staff our schools, it's important that we're intentional about and ensuring we have the right level of expertise and the right level of our system. And so that means ensuring that we can have high quality teachers in every classroom, ensuring that we have specialized educators who can provide support to multiple schools, and ensuring that there is that support also at the agency of education. So when we talk about this work, it's really critical that we're thinking about the best way to align our resources and ensure that we have the right educational support and staff at every level of our system. And that will be part of our ongoing work and thinking about this plan being about achieving that opportunity for students and making sure that we get the right resources in the right places in our system, because we know we have a lot of vacancies, we know we have a lot of turnover, and this is an opportunity for us to, through this plan, ensure every child has access to high-quality teacher in their classroom, along with specialized support within the region.
Related to David's question, I think, is consolidation of school districts. And, that's long been a goal of Governor Scott's well before this new plan was announced. But when it comes to a decision to close a small school or consolidate one district with another, how would that decision be made under this new plan?
There's a distinction here between talking about governance at the school board level and talking about consolidation at the school level. When we're thinking about the larger districts, this is designed to promote more shared responsibility of a larger group of students to enable us to promote equitable decision-making and equitable policies. So a larger region creates that shared ownership. And it also allows us to create central office teams that are more robust in being able to deliver services to schools that currently may not be able to access those specialized supports. And then when we think about consolidation at the school level, that's about building strong schools that are operating at a scale to deliver a range of educational opportunities. Right now in the state of Vermont, we have some schools that can offer art and foreign language and other schools that aren't able to do that. And the intent of this plan is to ensure that we have really strong schools that are able to deliver an array of high quality educational services and meet the whole needs of every child. And to achieve that, we need to be clear around defining our education quality and measures and also financial solvency and ensuring that a school is equipped to do that. Considerations around consolidation are always really challenging, and we need to approach this work with students in mind. It's in shifting the focus around loss to what are the opportunities that students could gain through two schools combining in a way that gives them more resources to offer more for students. We also need to be really practical when we approach this work. We know that some of our schools are in communities that are very remote. And so we're going to be intentional around defining those schools that are small by necessity versus schools that are small by choice. And that will be a process that will establish very clear criteria and guardrails, and ultimately will be involve community input in making those decisions to ensure that we can deliver on opportunities for students.
Secretary Saunders, let me piggyback off that point, because we got this question from Stacy in Tunbridge, who says this plan, in her view, removes local control in the end. How can this be avoided? People move to Vermont, she says, for local control and a more involved community for their schools. This removes that. Why can't we work this out? We want people to stay and move to Vermont, but this feels like just another reason for me to sell my property and move. I love Vermont, says Stacy, but this feels lacking in originality and an actual concept that can be laid out before a vote. How would you respond to Stacy's concerns on local control?
I think what's really wonderful about Vermont is we have such a strong commitment to education and believe in the high level of engagement of community members. This plan is designed to engage community members in very meaningful ways. So currently, we know that a lot of the decision-making when we talk about local control is around the budget. And unfortunately, much of that focus in the last couple of years has been around what do we have to cut? And it's sometimes very difficult at that local level to make those challenging decisions without the clear parameters. And then what we see playing out in practice is that our higher needs communities tend to struggle the most to pass their budgets. And that often means that they're going to continue to cut more and more services. And the concern is that if we continue with that current system, there will be a greater divide between the haves and the have-nots in our state. And this plan is designed to make sure that we're equitable with the way we resource our schools. In terms of actual engagement, there's a lot of opportunities for parents and community partners and caregivers to be engaged in their child's education. It's shifting from thinking about making those really tough budgeting decisions and focusing more around how do we align our resources and support to meet the needs of students. So there's really two key mechanisms within this plan to achieve that. One is at the school board level, there will be larger regions and ensuring that schools benefit from a larger set of resources and support than many districts are able to offer now. And then each school will have a school advisory council, which would engage community members and parents and caregivers and students in making decisions around that school improvement plan. So thinking about the best ways to implement strategies that are going to meet the needs of students. And we think with this approach, it's really achieving the goal for Vermont of establishing a balance between unity and freedom. With the larger regions, we're able to achieve unity in terms of set goals to ensure educational quality and equity for students that have a diverse set of needs, and then able to also at that very local level at the school to customize choices and programs to meet the needs of those students. So in effect, this plan is really designed to promote greater engagement at that local level on those decisions that I think really impact students and teachers and parents on a daily basis.
One more question for you, Secretary Saunders. I know your time is short here. The new formula proposes a statewide standard to coordinate what school curriculums would look like. What would those standards be? How would they be decided?
Yeah. So we have a really good framework to start on in Vermont. We've focused a lot on how we define educational quality. And through our Listen and Learn tour, we ask those very specific questions. How are you defining student success? What conditions are needed in order to promote academic excellence for every child? And then how do we help to support from the agency of education? So we've heard really clearly that there's a need for us to be more clear around those goals, and also for the agency to be able to provide clearer guidance and support and training as we move to achieving those high standards. Over the next several months, I expect that we'll have a lot of robust conversations and getting concrete in those high leverage education quality standards and making sure that those are the things that we think are most important to student outcomes. And with everything that we do at the agency, this work needs to be based on research and data driven, and also takes into account some of the implementation considerations on the ground. So I think this is an exciting opportunity for us to come together and really think concretely around education quality. And ultimately, when we're talking about quality and we're talking about equity, we're talking about the opportunities for students in our state and making sure that we are giving them a world-class education, that they're able to really have a well-rounded experience in their schools that allows them to achieve at high levels and that challenges them with academic rigor and also engages them in exploration around, you know, the arts and college and career. And that is a really exciting opportunity for us as a state to get clarity on that so that we can focus our efforts and align our initiatives and our resources to make sure that every student can benefit from those experiences.
Secretary Saunders, I appreciate your time today. I do hope when more details of this plan come out, you'll be able to join us again and really dig into some of those details. I would really appreciate that.
I'd be happy to, and we're really eager to continue to share information and dig into the details. We're also very committed to capturing the different considerations from our community to make sure that this plan is addressing what we all achieve, which is to really strengthen our public education system and to promote greater opportunities for our students and also our teachers.
Vermont's Education Secretary Zoe Saunders, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you for having me.
We have to take a quick break, but stay with us. Coming up next, we'll get reactions from the head of Vermont's Teachers Union and the executive director of Vermont's Rural Education Collaborative. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Michaela Lefrak. If you're just tuning in, we are examining the new education plan for Vermont being put forward by Governor Phil Scott. We just heard from Education Secretary Zoe Saunders, and our next guests have a serious vested interest in how all this shakes out as well. And listeners, you can join this conversation. Give us a ring at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You could also send an email to us to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. And joining us now is Don Tinney, president of the Vermont National Education Association. That's the state's teachers union. Don, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we also have in the studio with us John Castle, Executive Director for Vermont Rural Education Collaborative. John, thank you so much for your time today.
Glad to be here.
Don Tinney, let me start with you. What is your initial reaction to this new education proposal based both on what you heard from the governor yesterday in his budget address and Education Secretary Saunders just now?
Well, I think first and foremost, we have to remember that our students are getting a great education in Vermont, and they absolutely deserve the best schools that we can provide. And our educators work every day to meet the needs of children and youth of this state. And our Vermonters appreciate that. Vermonters have told us time and time again that they support their local public schools. Now, they want to change how we fund the schools, but they do not want to change the entire system of public education. So the votes were against the property tax, not against our public school system.
Interesting. So what you heard from Secretary Saunders saying just now, you know, a lot of what she said that there's going to be funding in this new proposal, this new formula for increasing teacher pay, you know, which is something I'm sure that the teachers union would love to see. Funding things like art, music, you know, and early education programs. So all of that sounds good. How do you feel about the formula to achieve that and make that happen, given that all these things are expensive?
Well, we haven't seen the details of the formula yet, so it's really hard to react to that. I mean, we know that we need to increase educator pay right now. As Senator Sanders proposed, you know, the starting salary for teachers should be $60,000 a year. We believe that starting wages for our education support professionals should be $30 an hour. You know, we talk about affordability crisis. Our profession is facing an affordability crisis. We have educators who can't afford to stay in education. We have many of our support professionals working two or three jobs, and one job should be enough in America. And so we definitely need to continue to figure out how we can compensate our educators fairly so we can keep them in the classroom.
John Castle, I imagine that a lot of concern for the Rural Education Collaborative deals with the question of consolidating districts and potentially closing some smaller schools in Vermont, which many of which would likely be in more remote areas of the state. We got this comment from Lisa in Craftsbury. She says, "In looking at Governor Scott's education plan, I back it. Vermont's population is the size of one of the U.S.'s larger cities, yet in 2022, Vermont had 98 school districts with 293 schools and 83,000 students enrolled. That means a lot of administrative costs for each district. There will be a lot of talk about loss of local control, but really, there is currently very little in a school budget that school boards can control because of mandated spending. We need to try a new model." Do you think this new model addresses her concerns, and does it address your concerns as well?
Well, I think there's a lot to consider in this whole proposal. And certainly, as Don indicated, there's some things in terms of details that we don't have. First off, I want to say how much I appreciate our educators across the state, the hard work that they do and the good work they do in teaching our students, but also our school boards. I think we have amazing school boards that make tough decisions annually on school budgets. And first and foremost, are stewards of our children, but also stewards, obviously, of our taxpayers' resources. So I worry about this proposal in that it is not the right size. And I understand the governor talked about right sizing, but we have to right size and we have to have the right values. And I think, you know, very large districts, five across the state, there's actually research that supports a diseconomy of scale. If you can get too big, right, that you aren't able to effectively meet the needs and resources of your outlying school communities. And I think, you know, certainly we have to recognize the rural context in which we live. And that has some challenges inherently in our state. But I think we have to work with the resources we have and look at creative ways to redistrict and maybe make some larger units for efficiency. But, you know, I have to say, you know, a lot of that was the goal of Act 46. And I think, you know, it's very hard to pinpoint and illustrate whether that was successful. There hasn't been a full-fledged analysis of that implementation, which is less than 10 years old at this point. But I do worry about very large districts and their ability to serve the needs of outlying rural communities.
We actually got it.
And the issue around consolidation, which I can further speak to. I think that is one of my largest concerns, is that this actually creates the conditions for further consolidation of schools. And yes, I recognize that there will be small schools that may need to close because of challenges of viability. But I feel like this is a clear intent to create the conditions for closure, large-scale closure of small schools, which I think is very problematic in our rural communities.
I mean, that's such a tough decision to make. You're saying that something's probably got to give. Some small schools may have to close. How that decision gets made, which schools, is very difficult, isn't it?
It's extremely difficult. I've experienced it myself, right, as a superintendent. The school that I attended as a child, that I was once the teaching principal, Holland Elementary School, closed on my watch. That was a decision the community made, and it was my job to provide an objective process and help that community go through that process. And I think that's what we need to do. We need to provide the technical assistance and guidance for communities to navigate that, which is a very emotional process and very difficult. And I do think once you start to have schools that are below 50 students, it becomes really challenging to operate programmatically effectively and also financially effectively. What I would be very concerned about is concentrating that authority in the hands of the Agency of Education and the Secretary based on some matrix that I would feel is very difficult to create an honest and metrics with integrity that could be a guidance for a sole person to make those decisions. I think these are decisions that need to be made by local communities.
By elected local community leaders, you're saying, that are elected to school boards?
Well, not necessarily just their boards, but the actual community.
Actual community. Yeah. Okay. You mentioned Act 46, John, and I want to throw this question out to Don as well, because we got this question regarding Act 46 from Constance in Hancock, who says, here in Hancock and Granville, we already closed our village schools to save on taxes. Then Act 46 directed us to merge our districts and consolidate resources, which we were told would create economic efficiencies and improve educational outcomes. Instead, not even a decade into Act 46, we saw a nearly 30% increase in taxes last year. How does the plan to further consolidate and close more schools intend to achieve a different outcome? Don, let me throw that question to you first. Is that a concern that you have as well when we start looking at consolidation?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's this assumption that consolidation is going to save a ton of money, and we simply don't have the evidence. And John can speak to that from his lens as a superintendent better than I can. But I do want to completely agree with John's point about where decisions are made. And it's incredible. You know, our local school boards work really, really hard every year to create budgets that meet the needs of our students at the local level. And now we're going to take that away. So I think the centralization of power in the school system is of great concern. So thanks for bringing that up, John.
Let's take a call now from David in Wilmington. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. I would just like to know, how many jobs do these educators and school budgeters think that taxpayers should have to have in order to pay what they want to run their system the way they want to run it?
Okay, I'm not sure exactly what your question is there, David. I mean, you're asking about – sorry, take it again. It was probably my misunderstanding, I'm sure.
Well, one of the former speakers said that the teachers have to have two or three jobs in order to live in Vermont because they're not getting paid enough.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm saying is, how many jobs does a taxpayer have to have in order to pay their school taxes?
I see. So you're concerned about the school taxes issue. Don Tinney, let me see if you can address David's question there.
Well, in America, everyone should be working one job, and we need to look at how we can raise wages and salaries so that it is affordable for Vermont. We talk about expenses. We talk about, you know, the cost drivers of housing, of health care, of food. All of these things contribute to the affordability crisis, as the governor has pointed out. But one of the pieces of that equation is that wages have been kept low. So we have to insist upon the corporate ownership class increasing the wages for working people. And once we do that, then folks will have the funds necessary to meet all of their obligations.
Would you both agree, and let me start with you on this one, John, that regardless of this new proposal, the status quo as it was simply wasn't working? And I'm not talking about Don's point about the kind of education that Vermont students get, which a lot of schools do a wonderful job with. But at least according to the vast majority of Vermonters who shot down so many school budget proposals last year, some repeatedly, I mean, what do you envision as the foundation for an alternative if this new plan put forth by the governor isn't satisfactory?
That's a good question, Mitch. I feel like, yes, there does definitely needs to be some structural changes and systematic changes across the board. It's very difficult in terms of our system, in terms of the decisions for spending are made locally, and then that funding comes from our state. In many ways, ironically, there are other states that look at envy of Vermont, and we have a very equitable funding formula. It's certainly not perfect. What I'm concerned about is that last year was the first year of implementation of Act 127, which increased weights. We're only now into the second year of that, so I think it needs time to...
Can I back you up there and please explain to me,
sure.
Like, Act 127 increases weights. What do you mean by that exactly?
So in terms of our current funding formula, there is an amount that, is based on a dollar yield that is based on an average daily membership in terms of the student number in that particular school. Hmm. And there's an additional weight that is given for students that are from poverty, students that are English language learners, some considerations for rurality. And so those kinds of weights give an additional taxing capacity to a school district in order to fund their needs. And so that change went into effect last year for the first time, and it was a little bit of a choppy rollout. And so I think, the confluence of things last year really exacerbated things. We had the decrease of federal funds. We had, record high inflation in the country and in our state. We had healthcare costs that really went through the roof. Upward pressure on labor costs that's very dynamic in the educational field right now. So I think we have to recognize that and acknowledge that. I don't think we're going to see the same level of problem this year. I know some of the early projections were around 6%, but I think given the reintroduction of the excess spending threshold that was put into play, that was not in play last year, that is certainly, giving boards cause to think about their budgets and make some of those tough staffing decisions, which is difficult, but I think boards, should be making those decisions at their local level given their understanding of their needs. So I do think changes are in the mix and in the need. I do think there are things that we can change to the way we fund education. And some of that may be looking at, I understand the issue of equity, but even if we move to a foundation formula, we're still relying on weights to increase the overall revenue for a school district. We could shift to more categorical aid. That would be aid specifically directed to student needs. And so that's an area that I think needs further exploration. And I really feel that, looking at the general fund and how we look at a general fund transfer. That's always a question about how do we, what we utilize for education versus what we use for general fund. And over the years, we've put more and more pressure on the education fund, which is based on our property taxes. And I think we do need to look at that model.
We got the
same. John makes a really
go ahead, Don, please.
John, you make a really good point about all the things that we're taking out of the using the education fund to pay for, and we certainly should rethink that, particularly if it deals with issues that are not directly related to providing service to students. But one of the things that I think it's important to remember is to focus on the finance part, the funding part. You know, we've unveiled a three-step path to eliminating the education property tax that brings immediate relief to 50,000 middle-class families. So right this year, we could make adjustments to the income sensitivity formulas to provide immediate relief. So we know that the metrics of that have not changed, have not been adjusted for inflation. And to continue to, as John said, ensure the education fund pays for education. And then the third step would be to institute an education income tax. If we use the income tax to raise more money and more fairly and more predictably than our current opaque system does now. So there is, I think we need to be looking at this from the financial side first, because that's the message Vermonters said. Vermonters said, we can't afford this tax increase. So focus on what those taxes, how those taxes are generated.
I want to give John the last word here, reacting to this email that we got from Aleth in Middlebury, who writes, I have always been confused by the notion that small schools somehow provide superior outcomes. It seems counterintuitive to me. Big schools have more services, programs, diversity. A small school with a low ratio might even provide too much handholding. Will they really prepare our kids in a complex world? I would absolutely choose a bigger school over a small school, all else being equal. What would you say to Aleth in those concerns, John?
I would say that the data doesn't support that either large schools or small schools are better. That in terms of student outcomes, both can be very effective. There are a lot of variables in terms of the quality of the teaching staff, leadership, curriculum, and opportunities that students are provided. Certainly, you know, a larger school would have an economy of scale and can provide some additional resources. But sometimes small schools provide amazing programs and things like place-based learning and community-based learning opportunities that a larger school doesn't have the ability to do. So I think, you know, my general statement would be there are good small schools and there are good big schools, and it's hard to differentiate based on size.
Okay, gentlemen, this is such a big, complex topic, and I apologize for not having more time to talk about it right now, but I hope that you'll both come back and be with us at another time as we dig more into the details of the governor's proposed plan. We've been speaking with John Castle, Executive Director for Vermont's Rural Education Collaborative. John, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And Don Tinney, President of the Vermont National Education Association, the state's teachers union. Don, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Happy to come back anytime.
That sounds great. And we have to take one more quick break. When we come back, education reporter Lola Dufour will join us for analysis and to answer any lingering questions you may have. Back in a moment. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Michaela Lafrac. And if you're just joining us, today's lesson plan, so to speak, is education and Governor Phil Scott's new plan for how it works and operates. We've heard from the state's education secretary, Zoe Saunders, and from Don Tinney, head of Vermont's teachers union, and from John Castle, executive director of Vermont's Rural Education Collaborative. And listening in has been Vermont's education reporter, Lola Dufour, who joins us now for some analysis. Hey, Lola.
Hey, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Let's start with what you heard from Education Secretary Saunders earlier. Does it sound like the administration has a decent handle on those devil-in-the-details plans that Don Tinney and John Castle have such concerns over?
Well, if they do, it sounds like they aren't ready to release that information yet. So we're still kind of in the place that we were last week when, you know, we are waiting on those sort of really key details that I think will dictate a lot of response, both from lawmakers but also stakeholders in the system.
What do you see as some of the biggest obstacles to implementing the governor's new vision for education funding? Again, he talked about we're going to increase teacher pay. We're going to fund art, music, and all these programs, early education, things people really like.
I think the biggest sticking point will be, like, how much money are we talking will actually flow to schools through this foundation formula? I think maybe there is a scenario where you can, in particular, bring up the bottom, which is what I think the governor is pledging to do. I don't think he's envisioning a scenario where, like, all teachers get a raise, but almost certainly where at least the lowest paid educators do. And so, you know, there is a scenario in which we bring up the bottom, but if you're also going to deliver on this demand for affordability, you know, how are you paying for that? How much are we pushing down the top? And we just haven't seen those numbers yet. And so that's almost certainly why you are seeing, folks at the State House say in concept, or at least a lot of folks at the State House, including a lot of Democrats, say, you know, we are in concept on board with exploring this idea, but that detail is really going to dictate whether or not we can say yay or nay.
Yeah, that was kind of my next question, because we can't ignore the political aspect to all of this. Democrats in Montpelier no longer have a veto-proof majority to nix whatever they don't like that's put forth by the governor. Based on what you have heard from Democratic leaders so far, are many of them willing to compromise with the governor to get something done here?
Absolutely. It really does sound like it. I'm hearing lawmakers on both sides of the aisle sort of say things out loud or just more forthrightly that they may have been a little bit more cagey about in the past. But, but the idea of a foundation formula is not new in Vermont. A foundation formula passed the House back in 2018 with bipartisan support. So, again, you know, but we don't know if the foundation formula that's about to come out is going to look like the one that passed in 2018 out of the House, not both chambers. And so, yes, I think there is sincere appetite on the part of Democrats to tackle real reform, maybe step on the political landmine that is local control, but we'll see once the actual modeling comes out whether or not they can get behind this. There's also, I think, the other issue, which is school choice, right? Public and private school choice, which we have in some communities. What happens to that if you go to larger districts? Is that expanded? Is that taken away? Or do they find a way to keep the peace by grandfathering the communities that already exist and not expanding it?
And that's complicated, too, by, I guess, recent Supreme Court decisions regarding how religious schools get funded. They are no longer out of that equation, right?
Right. If your community offers private school choice, you also have to offer private school choice to religious schools. And that has really ratcheted up tensions between kind of the public and the private school spheres in Vermont and also nationally. This question that has always been a pretty tense one in Vermont politics is now even more difficult to deal with. And we don't yet have any clear answers from the administration about how they would like to handle that.
Before we let you go, Lola, what are you eyeing as we start to get more details of this plan coming out? What are you sort of keen on looking for that would maybe help some more of these pieces fall into place for you?
I feel like I'm a broke, you know, I'm
It's okay. You can
myself,
say it again and again.
But it's the numbers, you know. I'm waiting to see what the modeling says and whether or not, a majority of communities feel like this benefits them. So that's – I think that's going to be the real moment of truth. And so that's what I'm looking towards.
And what about a time frame for that? I mean, do you see that coming soon? Do you think – because this is a 4-year phase-in plan that the governor is saying.
I don't think they can pass – well, even if you do a four-year phase and you have to pass a law this year, and I don't think you can pass a law this year unless we see numbers pretty soon. I've heard it's possible we'll see something this week. I think the secretary said so. But those numbers could also be like highly preliminary. And also just, you know, this modeling is tricky. Data collection has been really difficult for the Agency of Education, which has been kind of woefully understaffed for a very, very long time. Plus, you're trying to collect data from across the state, And so getting numbers that everyone feels good about in terms of their actual integrity, like, can you trust these numbers?
Yeah,
is going to be difficult in addition to like, okay, sure. Does everyone feel good about how much money this is actually going to send to their districts?
We'll have to leave it there. Lolo Dufour, our education reporter, thank you so much for the time. And thank you so much for listening to Vermont Edition today. I'm Mitch Wortlieb in for Michaela LaFrac, and we'll speak again soon.